Minen chapter 10, we're supposed to start at 10. Good morning, DT and your team. Thank you for coming. I know this meeting was the original schedule for last Friday, but because of some challenges on the part of members, we could not continue on Friday. This week we're supposed to be having a NCOP program called Local Government Week. That program has been now rescheduled to next week. And we had to quickly find something to do as a committee. We asked our committee secretary to check the department to come and present this week, because some of our meetings were scheduled for next week, so we had to swap with the NCOP. So thank you for making time. I know it has caused some inconvenience, particularly on the part of the minister, who had confirmed to come for Friday, but I understand now he's not here and have an apology in front of me from the minister. So yesterday I received a message from the committee secretary that the deputy minister was also ready to come and attend the meeting. She took ill. She was, I understand that she was ill for some time. I phoned her last week only for her to tell me that she's come recovering. I was not even aware that she was not sick. So I then wish speedy recovery. We are going to introduce ourselves. My name is Mandla. The surname is Hai. R-A-Y-I. Hai. I'll ask other members to introduce themselves. And then I'll ask the DG to introduce the
Good morning. My name is Willem Faber and I represent the Northern Cape in the NCFB on this committee.
Morning, Chair. Colleagues from the Department of Transport. I'm Eddie Makuwe from Gauteng Province.
Good morning. I am Masipa Bonifani from Limpopo Province.
Good morning, DG and the team. My name is Musi Mangwewu. I'm from the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable members of the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for inviting us. As you have indicated, we were originally expected to be on Friday. We appreciate the opportunity for inviting us, the Department of Energy, to present to you our short-term APP and budget vote. You have also indicated in your invite, Chair, that you'd like some input that relates to NERS and ESCOM. And in our midst, we have the Team Energy, which I'm leading, which will be presenting to you this morning, Chair. We also have our CEO from NERSA, who's present, who will deal with NERSA-related issues as the communicator. We also have the office of the IPP chair, as we have made some requests to get some updates in relation to that and all those presentations, and they will be attended to this morning. Chair will focus on our struggling as per your request for 2018-19 financial year, as the department has a responsibility in terms of performing within this financial year as guided by various oversight committees of government. Chair, we would like to focus mainly on our core business. We know that in our presentation that we have submitted, we've provided some background information just to remind ourselves about our mandate, who we are, and how the Department of Energy has been established. We have also reflected, Chair, on our organization's level. Let me say right up front that the department has already started to deal with the vacant posts that exist, particularly in the area of energy programs and projects, clean energy, corporate services, as well as financial governance and compliance. The department, together with the minister, have started the process. Advertisement was done. We are busy trying to expedite that process as to try and deal with operational challenges that may have to be dealt with in the event we find ourselves failing in this as we perform in the financial year. We have also reminded the team and the committee on how do we work with different entities. We have highlighted those entities that we currently have, some of whom who are tasked by different pieces of legislation to perform certain mandates representing the Department of Energy. We will then, Chair, get into the meat of our presentation, and I've requested Lloyd Kanta, our acting DG, to take us through the presentation, and thereafter we'll focus mainly on the financial part of our presentation to be done by our Chief Director, Ms. Pamagwini, and she will take us through the financials of our financial year, and that will lead into the conclusion of our presentation, Chair. And once again, I must express the apologies we have received of our Honourable Minister and Deputy Minister for not being part of this meeting this morning, Chair, as per the communique received by the Secretariat of your office. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. No, I was there. What was that? The first challenge is to introduce your team. But let me also welcome our Honourable President, I mean, Honourable Member Kebe from the Northwest. But we also have apologies also from our side as the members, Honourable Lodge, as well as the Honourable Wouter. Those are the apologies from our side. But just before the presentation, if you can introduce for us your team. But we also from our side have the parliamentary staff, Zulu, the committee secretary, Mr. Dumo Fisuba, who's our content advisor, and Mr. Martin, who's our committee staff with them, the gentleman from PMT. Another chair.
Sorry, Chair, just on the apology from the Honourable Walter. Do we have a written apology from him? I'd like to see what he says in the content. The reason why I'm
check that, because I remember last week you raised that point. So I checked with the committee secretary, because I have in front of me the written one from the minister. But then I checked with her, she said there is a written apology. It's in the form of an email.
No, what I wanted to check, Chair, is it an apology for an extended period, or is it an apology only for this meeting?
I think we'll have to follow up. I think it's a point, good point that you're raising, because it has not been to Parliament this year. So we need to find out whether it's been an apology. Because if it's more than 15 days, then his party has to send a motion to Parliament, and so we must adopt and give him his extended leave. I think it's a matter that we'll have to follow up with the Office of the Chief Whip, so that the Office of the Chief Whip can follow it up with his party, the DSF. Back to you.
Thank you, Chair, for running fast. My name is Tabani Zulu. I work for the Department of Energy as the Director General. I would ask my team to introduce themselves and I can get familiar with their voices.
morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. My name is Lloyd Kanta. I'm the acting DG for Governance and Compliance for Intervention.
Good morning,
Chairperson.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Kamakwini Mjenga. I'm the Chief Director of Finance.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members and colleagues. My name is Nonsanda Ndebele. I'm from the Office of the Director General.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Sandy Linda. I'm the Secretary of the Regulator.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. My name is Chris Foley. I'm the CEO of NERSA.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. I'm Mohadi Mutise, acting DDG Clean Energy.
Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, good morning. Gwena Mahotu is my name. I'm the acting DDG Corporate Services.
Honourable Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lucas Mutawi, Chief Director, Strategy and Risk Management.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Abed Nigoshungwan. I work in the Office of the Director General, Department of Energy.
Good morning, members. Good morning, colleagues. My name is Caroline Mbeyevu. I work in the Office of
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Member. My name is Matuna Kobeni. I'm representing the IPP office.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Member. My name is Jeva Mbele. I'm the DDG Programs and Projects.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Members. My name is Thaba Odas. I'm the Acting DDG Policy and Planning.
Good morning, Nonke. Honourable Chair, honourable members, Samalam Dumpa Melawa Dayan, PLO to the Deputy Minister.
Over to you. But what I wanted to suggest is that let's deal with the presentation of the Department of Energy first, together with the budget, and then we ask members to ask questions. And you respond, and we adopt the report. Because we need to have a quorum by the time we adopt the report. Because there may be apologies, I don't know for now. Sometimes members have other meetings. If one member leaves, yeah, we won't have a quorum. Because our quorum is based on the provinces. We need to have 5 provinces to have a quorum. But if any of the provinces leave him, won't have a quorum and won't be able to adopt your APP and the budget. Then after the APP and the budget, then we can have other presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, for the guidance. As I've already outlined background to our presentation and certain areas that we're dealing with, I will go straight to Program 1 of the department and focus on the core of what is entailed there, and I'll allow our acting DDG, Lloyd Kanta, to take us through that, and thereafter I'll request our Chief Director of Finance to take us through the financials, and that should conclude our presentation on the Chairperson, with your permission. Right.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning, members. Program 1, which is the administration program for the Department of Energy, consists of the Ministry, the Digital Office, the Governance and Compliance Branch, CFO and Supply Chain, Audit Services, and Corporate Services. The program is primarily responsible for providing strategic leadership to the department and management and support services. I'll just go to the plan targets and KPIs for some of the key target KPIs for the 2018-19 financial year. So as the committee might have heard, the department will be hosting the BRICS Energy Minister during our chairship of BRICS We'll also be hosting the senior managers from the different countries. Next month, the department will be hosting the senior managers here in Cape Town, and then the minister meeting will follow later on. We'll also be hosting the static energy minister meeting, and the department is currently busy with the preparations for both sectoral meetings, which are due to be held within the next 2 quarters. Program 2, members, is the energy policy and planning program, which looks at energy, improve energy security, liquid fuel energy security, policy and regulation, and planning for bulk electrical infrastructure. Some of the key targets for the year 2018-19 for this program include the completion of the gas demand supply analysis in plan for the Envisage Gas to Power program, completing the gas infrastructure master plan, and also developing a regional gas master plan in conjunction with our SADC member countries. We'll also be developing regulations to support the implementation of the Gas Amendment Act. We'll also finalize a proposal to be submitted to Cabinet for new oil refinery implementation framework. We'll also be finalizing, developing and finalizing proposal on Control 2 implementation framework. The department is also planning to get approval, cabinet approval for a biofuel pilot program during the year under review. And we'll also be finalizing a proposal to be submitted to cabinet on the end state of the electricity industry. One of the other things that we'll be doing together will be to review the electricity pricing policy and the electricity pricing curve. And we'll also be finalizing proposals for the National Energy Regulatory Amendment Bill, taking into account comments which were previously made by Cabinet and other stakeholders. The rollout framework for the Municipal Asset Management Program will be developed during the year under review. And also, we plan to conclude the intergovernmental agreement for the transmission line in relation to the INGA project, and you know, with the transmission line for that. Program 3, which is the petroleum and petroleum product regulation branch, and this program is primarily responsible for the monitoring and enforcement of compliance with petroleum legislation, licensing, and fuel supply. We do the monthly fuel pricing, and also we have regional fuel regulation offices around the country. Some of the key targets for this branch for the year under review include the conducting 1,500 retail site compliance inspections, conducting 1,080 fuel samples, testing 180 fuel samples at different retail sites, publication of the audit report on the petroleum transformation, and publication of the petroleum and industrial sector code, and ensuring that at least 50% of all applications which are approved have 50% ATSA ownership. Program 4, which is the electrification and energy program and project management. This program is primarily responsible for the INEP electrification program. It's responsible for the DOE project and project management office. And we also are responsible for energy infrastructure. Some of the key targets for this branch include ensuring that we have quarterly reports on the number of households which are electrified with grid connection towards the have contracted with Eskom municipalities. We will also be reporting on additional households which are electrified in non-grid towards the annual target of 20,000. The department is also responsible for some of the rural IDCs, independent energy centers, integrated energy centers, and will be monitoring their performance and reporting on those on a quarterly basis. Chair, slide 26 and 27 just provides a breakdown of the connections municipality of the province from both Eskom and municipal plan. Program 5 is the nuclear energy branch, which is responsible for nuclear safety and technology, nuclear mass conservation and radiation security, and nuclear security. Some of the key targets for the nuclear branch include ensuring that 70% of all authorization applications are processed within the 8-week period. The branch will also be finalizing a policy on decommissioning and decontamination. We'll also be working on finalizing the NNR amendment bill for submission to cabinet. The branch also in the final stages of developing a radioactive waste management fund bill, which will then be submitted to the chief technical advisor for certification. Program 6 is the clean energy program, which basically is responsible for energy efficiency, renewable energy, climate change response, and the designated additional authority. Some of the key targets for this branch include ensuring that energy savings are realized and verified in all our EEGSM projects towards the target of 0.5 terawatt hours. We'll also be finalizing the post-2015 National Energy Efficiency Strategy for promulgation. We'll draft the renewable energy technology roadmap during the year under review. And also we'll ensure that the solar water heater program is monitored, the implementation thereof is monitored, and quarterly reports are submitted. The last target there is that we ensure that the carbon offset registry for lithium offset, for credit offset, and into carbon offset administration is developed and implemented. Now, part C is financial information, and I will ask Mr. Chair to take over.
Thank you. The allocation of the department for the 2018-19 financial year is 7 billion. Out of that 7 billion, 91.24% is allocated to transfer payments. The remaining balance of that of the 7 billion, it goes to the operations of the department. When compared to the 2016-17-18 financial year, our budget was reduced by 1.1 billion, which is 13%. This was due to the fiscal constraints. The final budget compared to the indicative budget of the MTF was reduced by 1.4 million. Also, that was due to pressures in the fiscal. However, we were given an increase in compensation of employees. The reason for that mainly is that the department from 2014-15 has always had a deficit in the budget. It has not been able to grow in terms of filling vacant posts, and also the budget was insufficient to cover the headcount. So we got an increase of 28.62 million from Treasury in order for us to fill vacant posts and be able to cover the current headcount. Under goods and services, we had a reduction mainly on solar water, but we also had an increase for rental of office buildings, because also in the past the department has not been able to cover the rentals for the building. And in transfer payments, which is the one that takes the bulk of the budget of the department, due to the fiscal constraints that I referred to, Treasury had to take some money to redistribute where there were shortfalls in the fiscal. In slide 38, that is a breakdown of each program, how much each program got. Administration being program one, it got 282 million, and program two, 53 million, program three, 87 million, electricity program four, it got 5 billion. The 5 billion in program four is mainly where the transfers are sitting. Nuclear energy got 816 million, clean energy got 370, which in total then adds to the 7 billion. Below in that table, it details what program one got for each sub-program. In terms of economic classification, the allocation, the compensation of employees, because of the increase, we got a final allocation of 360 million. Goods and services for the operations of the department, 252 million. Transfers and subsidies, 6 billion. And capital assets, that was 4 million. And that adds to the total of 7 billion. Slide 39, it explains per program as what was the movement. Mainly for most of the programs, 1, 2, and 3, there has been just a slight increase in terms of compensation of employees. Four, there was an increase in terms of compensation of employees, but what is more prominent is the reduction on transfer payments for INEP and ESCOM. Program five, there was a reduction as well there. And program six, there was also a reduction on solar. However, in terms of compensation, they all got an increase. In slide 40, Chairperson, I won't go into details. It is the movement in terms of the MTF being the 2018-19 and 2020-2021. So for the 2019-20, there would be changes once the final allocations are done. I have covered 2018-19. I think the other slide is more elaborating on the MTF, not the EME, the 2018-19. So I can end there. Thank you.
The last few slides just dealt with some of the key challenges facing the department, both internally and also the industry that the department is responsible for. The first two challenges, which is funding and capacity constraints, which actually stem from the budget baseline from the creation of NGO, where the department does not have enough funding to be able to effectively implement programs and also just implement its main data. I think this has been a challenge, an ongoing challenge, where we've been unable to even fill some of the vacancies because of there wasn't funds available to be able to do that. The electricity supply and demand balance, that we hope in that in the finalization of the IRP will provide a long-term view, and also the annual report which is submitted by ESCOM to NARPA provides a short-term view on the supply and demand balance. In terms of the slides on the end state of electricity industry, which is in progress in new entrants and reform. The department is currently developing an entry concept paper which will be used to guide the required policy changes to ensure that we go as required later. The electricity distribution infrastructure network Gideon remains a challenge, and the capacity department within the current financial year conclude the framework including funding model to address distribution infrastructure, etc. We are, if I may add, that this is also in consultation with both CASA and National Treasury on how to answer the question. Progress in the electrification program, there is continuous engagement at the executive level between GUI and ESCOM to improve oversight of the electrification program and also to ensure that we begin to do more with the reduction in the budget. The rollout of the solar oversight program remains a challenge for the GUI. A pilot phase has been implemented to be followed by sufficient capacity and allocation. Recent crude oil increase and temporary fluctuation and the impact on the petrol price and the economy as a whole. I think that there is no short-term solution to this one. I think this is more of a long-term where we need to really, as a government, continue our efforts to encourage information around our coastal areas. Biofuel implementation, with regard to this challenge, the subsidy module is being researched to determine original benefits vis-à-vis the current oil price and exchange rate fluctuation. And based on the feasibility studies, the vehicle is going to have the potential to create about 15,000 jobs. And also the pilot to test the ability of the subsidy module will be developed during this period to ensure that we can then start working on opportunity in the subsidy. The updated IRP and the planning tool for petroleum futures supply. IRP was submitted to cabinet in December 2017, and the department is currently addressing comments made and consulting with our relevant stakeholders. And one of the other challenges which was raised was the misalignment between the station collection target and the budget to rise cap collection, especially in deep rural areas where there is low density and there is no infrastructure, so you have to start by infrastructure before you can connect our world. Our challenge is how to make the budget schedule, legal acquisition and illegal connection, migration which increases demand for electrification, especially in informal areas, and therefore reversal the progress made towards universal as transport. The lack of integrated planning by some municipalities to guide transport areas for electrification, and the lack of committed municipal units to plan all other instruments in line with contractual agreements with the utility. All of these challenges we've been working with the municipalities that cost us to address. And some of the things that we are doing there is to ensure that the municipalities are supported to access funding towards the state delivery. Municipalities are assisted to develop master plans in shoreline term planning. And also the increased frequent engagement with municipalities and the department. And also working with, as I indicated, with COPCA and such in short term training and management in particular. Next challenge that we looked at is negative publicity on the energy development, and the department is working on the stakeholder communication strategy to show public awareness about the broader benefits of nuclear energy. Legislation that has been delayed in conclusion some of our key pieces of legislation amendments to some, and some of the interventions that we try to introduce to reduce some of the open-ended consultation processes, and also just develop action challenge is with regard to the in the youth program, both the main and the implementation to address funding of mitigation purposes and also to ensure that we follow in terms of low-level transformation, the department that I indicated earlier, we think we were finalizing an audit report on the electoral transformation, but also with the implementation, I indicated the signing of the window between the 2.5 and 4, you know, we're also trying to ensure that there's much more transformation in how these projects are implemented.
Thank you very much. We hope to hand over now to members there to ask questions, both on the APPs and also on the budget. Let me also welcome Honorable Mthethwa and Honorable Makhebu. Honorable Mthethwa is from KZN, and Honorable Makhebu is from Limpopo. Can I have hands? Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Twamba, Honorable Makwebu. That order for now.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG and the team. Once again, I would quickly go to slide number. Slide number 18. You have indicated, amongst other things that you plan to do in this current financial year, one of them is to develop the regional gas master plan. Now, what I want to find out is, developing the master plan is a process. When do you envisage to complete that? Is it during this financial year, or shall we look at the next financial year? Second question. Slide number 22, Chair. On petroleum products and regulation, you've got targets to set there. You know, I just want to find out, given your high vacancy rate and the targets you've put there on inspections and the samples to be tested, and my experience is that departments, you know, ideally they want to get there, but practically sometimes they struggle. I've heard the DG say that you have the process of filling this post with vacant posts for the DGs and others.
Okay. So you see, nothing's broken. For the empty cup, no energy wasted here.
Can I proceed now, madam? Thank you, Chair. Now, I heard the DG saying that the process of recruitment is currently underway, but processes take place. Can the DG give us a sense that, you know, when will this process be completed of filling this vacant post, so that we can have an idea vis-a-vis this reference I've made to this target on inspection to be conducted. Slide number 25. You have indicated that you intend to have quarterly reports on the issue of electrification with grid for the households, your target of 200,000 as the National Electrification Plan. And but when you go through your presentation, you have indicated the challenges that you have. I take it that the local municipalities, they are poor planning, they're not knowing what needs to be done sometimes. And I'm sure you have your interventions that you have in place. Amongst them, you've indicated that you, at the executive level, must be oversight with, you know, the electrification projects that you have. Now, my question is, through you, Chairperson, these electrification projects, because you also do oversight in the legislature, maybe they should share them with us so that we can do our own oversight. Then in that way we can assist, because this is critical for as politicians. We always look at the needs of the constituencies we represent. And I know in the Eastern Cape, there's still a challenge in the backlog on household electrifications. So, Chair, through you, I would request that the department share these projects with us, the list of these projects, where they are located, so that we can probably make time and find time to do oversight. If they're in our constituencies, that would be a bonus as well. We can, in our capacity as political parties, do that as well. Right, having said that, the issue of our slide number 30. Slide number 30, there's a bill there that you said has been sent to the state law advisor, that is Radioactive Waste Management Fund bill. I just want to find out, when was this bill sent to the state law advisor? I'm asking this question, Chair, because I know in Parliament we're trying to work with timelines, and the timeline for bills is, the cut-off date is May, last day of May this year. We would not process any bill in this financial year that came late after that date, after the 30th of May. I wonder if you're aware of that. So I'm raising this just as a heads up to say, look, there's a cut-off date for bills. After May, it will be processed in the next, I suppose, in the Sindh Parliament after elections. Then you would not have met your target. Unfortunately. On the financials, I have no questions, Chair. May I pause? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Let me appreciate the APP that was presented to us, because energy is such an important component for us as a select committee that's dealing with economic and business development. We will have many questions. I'll just pose some of them. On slide 9, you are referring to the South African Nuclear Energy Corporation. Two questions on that. The one is, I'm aware that Nexa has had some serious problems. I'm not going to go into the detail. But can you tell us in this APP whether those would be addressed? The second component of that first question is that when I visited Nexa, they were engaged in skills development in Bedindaro. And it was very impressive, the standard of the skills development program that they have there. And I just wanted to check, is that part of the new APP as well? My second question, Chair, is on slide 33, where you are referring to the draft renewable energy technology roadmap. Chair, through you, I would want to request that the department makes that draft available to us. My third question, Chair, is on slide 37, where you are indicating there at the bottom the 434.93 million that you've allocated on the solar water project. Now, you are saying that there are no funds earmarked, so I assume that you're actually rolling over funds. But then on slide 45, you are allocating right on top that you are in a pilot phase, implemented to be followed by sufficient capacity and resource allocation. Now, you're not going to get any resources. Is one of the things that impresses us when we look at the number of solar water installations, particularly for the poorer members of our society. Can you tell us what's going to happen there? Are we going to slow down, or would we be able to do it on pace? Because on the slide 45, you are talking about resource allocations, and there's not going to be any more resources. My next question, Chair, would be on clean energy. you on slide 38, he's allocating only 370 million to clean energy. We have a commitment in the UN to look at our carbon footprint. And looking at the concerns raised by the National Assembly is the reduction of the allocation on clean energy that they have raised with you. You may have given them answers, but you can you are also at liberty then, through your chair, to tell us what you are doing to deal with this challenge of ensuring that when we look at energy supply, we meet our international obligations vis-a-vis move away from polluter energy resources to resources that are more environmentally friendly. Can you give us an indication what is happening there? Are you actually going to concentrate on energy resources that are more environmentally friendly? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will move as quickly as possible, try not to break anything. Yes, Chairperson, I'm going to start off with oil prices, and I think that was on energy policy planning, gas infrastructure, and it started page 18. And it's about oil prices. Now, oil prices is about to go up, especially as from what I hear with President Trump, going ballistic again on that side. So we're going to get oil prices going up. Now my question on this is, our rolling stock which we illegally sold, what is the situation there? We understand that it was an illegal sale. I know there is a type of intervention to try and get it back, as it is actually still in our own wells where we haven't shipped it off to wherever. I would like to know, are we getting it back? Are we getting it back at the same price? Because that will obviously have an impact as well. So I'd like to know on that rolling stock, what is the situation on that? Then on gas, I haven't read anything in this report on planning on Shell gas. Now, I know Shell has apparently decided not to go on. What is the situation on Shell gas at this stage? Because I see nothing in your planning on that. It's under energy store. Okay, Chairperson, maybe someone's just got information off the record for us on that. Then on the last one, I'm going to ask the second last one. The electricity on page 44, clarity on in-state electricity industry is delaying progress in new entrants and regulatory reform. Now, I know in the Northern Cape, for instance, with Sun Energy, there's a lot of people that entered the market to get on the grid. And I know the minister made, about a month or two ago, the minister publicly came out and said that they are going on with the clean energy. What will the situation be there? Because you say it's delaying progress, it's actually one of your challenges in new entrants and regulatory reform. And then your intervention, it says in-state concept paper to be developed to guide the required policy changes. And I think that is very close to what Honorable Makua just asked, to ask on this development paper. By the required policy changes, what are you going to do about that to get these new guys in to produce clean energy? And that is all I'm going to ask for now, Chair.
Honorable Matthew Buna.
Thank you, Chair President. Mine is based on slide number 44. To improve oversight electrification on projects. I'm from a rural area in a small town in Giyani, So I've been speaking to two business people. They were Mr. Koso, who's having a chicken farm, and also Mr. Mabunda, who's having a brigade. So they were, I was asking them about their challenges, because their project has been operating without electricity since last year, without electricity. So they were telling me that in the challenges that we're having is about Eskom, because they take too long. When you apply for electricity, it will almost take you a year or 2 years, and then you have to go to the offices and pay a bribe before you get electricity. If you are not going to do that, they are going to take for a long time to put electricity on you. So I wanted to check on you, on your department. What are you doing to the challenges of corruption? What have you done so far, and how many people have you arrested on? Do you go normally to your this department and check whether the process of electrification, you check on how many people have they applied, when did they apply, and how far are they going to put electricity on their project?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My question also relates on the issues of the project electricity, but is different to what the Honorable Matibula was saying. I see here on slide number 26, the plan only talks about the household and not the project. My question is, with the project, where I come from, they don't pay bribe for Eskom to come and electrify their project. The problem is just that they don't allow them to use prepaid. And I see you don't have a plan of project here. And the ones that are giving them, immediately they install. After a month, you find that they owe something like 6,000 to 34,000. And now the project is just there with nice infrastructure, but they're not functioning because of this high rate of electricity. So I just want to know the plan when it comes to the project, and how far can you really assist those people? If ever you don't have a plan, how can you then assist them in future? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. This question that I missed, because it's not related to the presentation, but it is important, DG. I'm talking about BBBE. There is an article in yesterday's newspaper about this black young man who's complaining about the missed opportunity. I don't know whether you saw the article, but the essence of what I wanted to raise with you, because we have visited solar energy projects, wind energy projects in at least three provinces. And the concern that is being raised about ownership and skills transfer. Can you give us an indication what your plans are vis-a-vis the skills transfer? If I can give you two examples. When we were in Upington, we got to learn that the project is funded by a company in Spain, and they indicated to us that once the plant is built, the technical expertise needs to be provided. We had a good South African that was saying to us, but he's there, he understands it, but the locals aren't equipped. That's one example. The second one, and I think of Honorable Faber every time I think of this one. When we went to Koha, to Moha, we discovered that the windmills that were being used for energy production the area of those windmills are made of steel, and those steels are being imported from
South Korea.
I thought it was Italy.
South Korea.
But it wasn't South African steel, and we have a steel plant in our country. Now, my question is not about the steel plant. My question is, are we transferring that technology to have that equipment running? Because FDI has a time span. And what happens when it ends? Would we have expertise, particularly young people in South Africa, that would be able to keep those energy sources functioning efficiently and at maximum output? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Now, from here, normally I use the book, whether it's the annual report or APP. I don't rely much on the PowerPoint presentation, but I start from the foreword by the minister and compare the APP or the annual report with the previous one. I'm looking at both the 2017-18 APP and the 2018-2019. I see on the forward the minister says nothing with regard to the solar water heater program. I don't understand why. But also when you go to the budget, there's a huge drop. The point that Honorable Makuwe raised, there's a huge drop with regard to that particular program. But also I check what the APP said with regard to, for example, the state-owned entities. If I may read what the APP last year said with regard to the state, our work in this area includes, among others, strengthening the CEF subsidiary in the oil and gas sector, culminating in the creation of a standalone national oil company with Petrol SA forming nuclear. The national oil company will aspire to include operations in the upstream, midstream, and downstream industry. But in the 2018, there's no progress with regard to the establishment of this national oil company. If we can get an update with regard to that. But also on Grand Inga, I think it's just a changing of words. Otherwise, there's no difference with what was contained in the 2017-2018 and also 2018-2019. But even there, there's not much progress with regard to the Grand Inga. But with regard to the budget, I think most of the issues have been raised by Honorable Makuwe, particularly with regard to the huge drop on the clean energy. But I'm sure the general concern with regard to the reduction of the budget, what does it mean in terms of your achievement of the plan, and also what does it mean with regard to the targets set in the National Development Plan? Yeah. Over to you, DJ.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Select Committee for questions that have been presented to the team. Chair will address some of the questions, and some I will request my colleagues, especially the financial side, attend to, and some of the heads of branches are present. They can also give succinct responses to some of those. Let me deal with the question that relates to filling of vacancies. Chair, we are prioritizing the process. Having been dealing with the corporate services branch on a daily basis on this matter, I can assure the committee that at least within a period of 3 months we should have concluded. Already at an operational level, the process has been concluded. Advertisement has been done, CVs have been received,
the shortlisting process will be starting immediately with the panel to be established with the direction and guidance of the minister. As we all know, that the DDG at level is a cabinet responsibility. But we have done that, so we are prioritizing this, Chair. You have noticed that the branches that I've alluded to earlier on are key branches that are expected to provide operational efficiency in dealing with our mandate and the targets we have set for ourselves for the year that we are presenting for. So it is a high priority, Chair, and you'll imagine as a DG how difficult it could be to operate with many DDGs acting. It does have a psychological impact on you as the accounting officer, but also on the running of the department. So it's a high priority, and it's a matter that I deal with almost on a daily basis from my office to make sure it's dealt with. So the assumption is very correct from the Honourable Member that in the absence of this matter not being realised, this could have a direct impact on the targets and the work that we're doing in the energy side and for the government at large. The issue that relates to municipalities and projects or the program that we're doing with ESCOM, Chair, we will provide the information. We always make it a point from the beginning of every financial year that we enter into an arrangement with municipalities and also with ESCOM, who is also performing some of the work on our behalf. We have concluded that. We have signed those projects, but I think it is proper for honourable members to have a sense of which municipalities are working with for this current financial year, what budget has been set aside, which areas have we identified, so that we can be able to necessarily play your effective oversight role in those areas. So with your office, Chairperson, we will be providing the details of that information, which municipalities have I already signed arrangements with them, and also with ESCOM for work to be done. And also on quarterly basis, as you call upon us, we will be able to give you a sense of our performance. How are we doing in those areas? If there are any challenges, how are we trying to handle those challenges? So on quarterly basis, as a standard practice, we will be coming back to deal with those issues with the select committee. With regard to Nexa, Chair, I must say that all issues pertaining to Nexa are being attended to, and also there is an APP there for different entities, including Nexa, and skills development is part of that. But the challenges that are currently being experienced at Nexa, the Minister has prioritized that. We already had two meetings with Nexa to deal with some of the issues. In fact, one meeting was scheduled for last week, but due to changes, it couldn't happen. As you can see that the nuclear branch is not represented today because the DDG is attending to the same challenges that are currently taking place as directed by our Honourable Minister. So all the challenges that are there are being taken care of as expected, Chairperson and the Honourable Members. However, we'll keep you posted because this is a matter of public interest. This matter has been on news as well. So we'll be keeping the committee, but the Minister has prioritized as expected. And also the draft request, Chair, will be submitted to yourself. Coming to solar water heaters program, Chair, I know you have also raised this matter yourself. It does appear, Chair, on the AUPP for this year, on the forward, but unfortunately, Chair, it appears on my forward, and we have shared the forward with the Minister, so that it doesn't look the same. So the solar water program is under my forehead. Chair, is a challenge, and I'm glad that the Honourable Members have raised this matter quite sharply with a decline on our financial side of things. We have a challenge because in this financial year there is no budget set aside, but with the team, would like to continue with what we have started. We are now on the second phase of the project to do installations. So our strategy is to effectively deal with installations rather than to have our already completed manufactured geysers kept in storage. That's a plan we have had, and fast track that particular process. However, to continue continue with the rolling over of the project, we would like to approach Treasury to take cognizance of the impact that the withdrawal of this budget will have an impact on us. As you would know, Chair, that this year was also part of the MTN process planning in terms of the funds being put for this project. But I must say that on the project implementation side, we also have not been very effective to an extent that Treasury also became conscious about how we're performing. So we must also take responsibility as management that our capacity to implement this project was very limited and was very slow. But at least we've started and we have completed some of these and we have identified areas. We are now busy with installation. So it is our view, and we also had this item, Chair, just for your benefit, in our executive committee yesterday to say what strategies effectively can we put in place to make sure that this project doesn't fail. And amongst those things is to approach Treasury. But in doing so, we need to make sure that we have our house in order and our capacity strategy is clear and our financial requirement is clear and our project planning from now onwards is also clear. Treasury is very strict on projects like this. If we don't share serious concerns with them, then how are we capacitated to implement it? They can't just give the money. So we'll continue with the project. Our focus for this financial year will be on the installation side. We are contracting with relevant municipalities. We'll make sure that all the manufactured kits that have already been identified for storage are actually installed in the beneficiaries that have been identified. And the Honourable Member, you've raised the issue of the poor who have been waiting for this to happen. So that's our priority, to install what has been done but and continue to roll over. So I'm busy putting a strategy which would like to present to Treasury for this. But we also want to consult our strategic partners within the energy sector in particular, as always that we work with, such as Central Energy Fund and many others, to form part of an overall implementation team so that we can also tap into their skills, but where possible, we can also tap into their resources as part of the energy strategy. So we're busy with that energy. So whilst it's negative for now, we are putting a strategy of how effectively beyond installation we can continue to roll in the project and at the same time consult with Treasury for further assistance once it is clear how we intend to move forward on the project as we have dealt with the pilot phase. And I think in my view it's been successful, but installation would be more critical when the product is delivered to the beneficiary. For me, that's the last part of the project plan that could easily unlock more funds to continue with the project. On the carbon footprint, we know that we are conscious of that, and part of doing this exercise was to deal with that particular issue for 2025. But as you know that, Honorable Chair, our focus has always been to deal with our energy mix across the board, and we have been paying special attention on clean energy projects. And some of those projects that you can easily see in the Northern Cape and in the other areas to begin to introduce new methodologies of accessing electricity, I think it's been a success and we continue to do so. And also the recent signing of the project that focuses strictly on clean energy by the minister is also a significant move to begin to move with speed into that particular area. And it is correct, Chair, that most of the players in the clean energy space are of international stature. And most of the technologies that are being used to deal with this particular area of providing access to energy is technologies which are based with international. It's a global phenomenon that is beyond our control. In fact, there are very few local companies that have been able to zoom into this particular area. And that's why you see that most of the companies that are involved with even the funding is from the international investors who have been using these particular technologies in their respective localities and they've seen the benefit of it. So most of our local people, therefore, are engaging with them in a partnership, but the major component of the funding comes from the international funders, not from the local partners. What we have been doing together with the office of the IPP develop a funding strategy for our local people who are participating so that the issue of ownership and transfer of skills
mandatory in every project that we enter into. But that will require a very effective funding component. We'll be doing the same across the board, whether it's gas, whether it's coal, of course with the reduction component in mind to meet our emissions footprint, whether it's any project, because most of the people who have shown interest to play in our energy space are of international stature, and the funding that is mostly used in these particular projects is coming from international role players. And as a result of that, they then tend to take a bigger part of ownership using the funding tools that they have at their disposal. So what has become our responsibility in terms of our PPE, in terms of our local policies, and of ensuring that local people are able to play a major, meaningful role on the ownership is to make sure that they've got sufficient funding at their disposal. So we're busy identifying strategic financial institutions that could be of great assistance to that effect, who will understand our overall policy objective of participating, so as to deal effectively with the ownership component. It's going to be difficult to deal with ownership component if we don't deal with the funding mechanism that should help our local people to participate meaningfully on that. Be that as it may, though, Chair, I must confirm that every project that is entered into, agreed upon, signed upon, has that inherent component of ensuring that local participation does have a meaningful percentage on ownership. It's in writing. Part of our memorandum of understanding with the department and IPP office is to make sure that our policy guidance and directives from our constitution, from our PPE, is not compromised by virtue of the limited funding that our local players are having at their disposal, whilst we are dealing with a much more effective funding mechanism to assist the participation of our local people. In every project, there is participation, I can assure honourable members, but it's very limited because of the funding mechanism that is normally coming from international funders. But we are dealing with that matter moving forward. And we'll make sure that our local participation, therefore, is not compromised by their limited funding capacity at their disposal. I must indicate, Chair, that some of the issues relating to ESCOM, one may not be able to effectively comment on that because most of the big projects across the country, the supply is from ESCOM, and as you know, we still have the misalignment because ESCOM is reporting directly to DPE. We also give them some of our work, and then we hold them accountable through the SMAs and the business programs that we sign off. But if there are issues that relate to savings delivered from ESCOM side, I would recommend that people who are concerned, like the business people mentioned, if they can officially use our office to deal with that. The minister has already been dealing with some of the concerns that have been raised on the supply of electricity, and in some instances of cutting off electricity by ESCOM using its policy to do that. So you can refer those matters to our office, and we'll be able to deal with those issues as and when they arrive. We also have a hotline as well, which is being used to raise issues of concern. So we do not use the excuse that ESCOM is not part of us. As and when issues are being raised that relates to ESCOM, our minister is able to engage effectively in dealing with those. So I would highly appreciate if there are existing concerns from business people or any other individual households that they use the advantage of that hotline and our office to engage effectively with the institutions that are responsible for that. Chair, I think from my side, those are the areas that I would have preferred to deal with. And then I'll hand over to my team to deal with some of the issues that have been raised relating to finance in particular. Thank you, Chair.
In terms of finance, the budget reduction, as I indicated, is mainly on transfers, and the DDG responsible for that, the two DDGs responsible for that, will allude as to how it's affecting, it will affect the plan, the development plan. It's mainly on ESCOM and INEP municipality grants and also solar water. So they said
Thank you, Chair. I do have visitors who are part of the department in terms of delegations to them, in particular relating to establishment of a national oil company. We have the acting CEO from CERN, who is with us as well, and PetroSA, who is under CERN, is here with us. We have invited them to be part of this meeting so that we don't mislead the single committee on matters that we may not have prepared for. Also, Chair, as you would know, that the Minister established an inquiry on the sale of the strategic stock, which has been raised by an honourable member, which they are busy with. Though the matter it's in court and it's confidential, so there might be very economical with the information because the matter is now in court, but the Minister has delegated that responsibility to serve the Central Energy Fund to handle the matter. They are also here. They may want to share the information that may not jeopardize the legal process as it is currently in court. So, Chair, with your permission, I can ask them maybe if they can respond to those two areas that are related to their core mandate. Mr. Moore.
So, Chair, can I just talk here? Okay. Thank you very much, thank you, Chair, honourable members. On the two questions that DG said, the issue of strategic stock, honourable members, with the Chair, the oil is still in our tent. It has not left. We have filed the papers with the court. I think some members may have seen that. So the matter now is in the hands of the court, and we will actually update the members as we go along. But at this stage, I mean, the only reason why we have filed the papers is that we applied for declaration order as a state-owned company. We actually need to go to court to declare the contract invalid. So at this stage, we have put our case forward, and it will actually then depend on the court after the reply from the party as well. So that's where we are. But the point is still in our tent. It has not left. So I'm not able to answer where are we getting the oil, you know, at the price then or at the price now, which I mean that, you know, the cost would have to be determined. You know, how we do the next going forward. You know, after that, of course, then we will, the court will have to make judgment on the issues of, you know, what is the reasonable way moving forward after the event. On the issue of the National Oil Company, it's true, honorable Chair, the minister mentioned that to Parliament, she will come stage. So what we are doing now is that, we've signed ourselves, we've got different subsidiaries, and Petros is just one of them. We've got IDS, SSF, we've got the mining company. But we have embarked on the group strategy review. Because you see, the first step we want to take is actually go and look at how we structure the National Oil Company without being clear about the strategy. So we have been back on the strategy review. Our outlook is that around late end of May, mid-June, we should be done with that piece of work. And obviously we need to go to our principal of the department, you know, and share the strategy with them, and I think through the DG and the team, he will direct us accordingly to come and brief the committee on where we are. But that strategy review actually is meant to map the way forward in terms of how we move this forward. And I think that's where we are, and we will come back to share with you the ministry to update the committee latest as of June, I think, July.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The Grand Inga project is one of those projects that have been in our agenda for quite some time, Chair. As you know, that South Africa is a signatory to the treaty that was entered into for the Grand Inga. The Minister has prioritized this project for the benefit of the Select Committee. We are trying to capacitate the South African responsibility engagement on the project from the energy side. At some point, we even thought of deploying human resource capacity physically in the team that is dealing with this. The DRC has appointed one of the former ministers of energy to lead on the team that is dealing with this matter. So they are busy with it quite seriously. But I think we've been not very much engaged at a physical resource level to make sure that we are part of the decision-making process. The process of concluding is still taking place on the project. We know that they've been involved with the procurement regime of making sure that this project is taking a shape off the ground. But we've been informed that there were also some challenges from their side. And as a result, they've now recommended an establishing of a 12-committee committee, including six participants from South Africa who must form part of that team, so that there's an effective management of all processes. That's where we are, Chair. But if you can allow us, we can put and present just a full presentation just focusing on this project, because it's a cross-border project and we cannot cut corners on it. So we can do a standalone presentation just to give you an update of where have we been from the beginning, where we are, and where we are going with various proposals, and what work has been done to date in that project since South Africa is a signatory to this treaty. Chair, I think we can do that. Or alternatively, we can just write a full report for your members just to get a first-hand background on where we are on the project.
I just allow members for follow-up questions and the questions that they asked. I know, Honourable Makov, you raised the issue of the bills that are still with the state law advisors and all that stuff. But normally what happens is that even ourselves as the fifth parliament, we deal with some of the legislation that were processed in the previous term. But because of a term constraint with the previous term, and then they are carried over to the next step. Yeah. So some of the bills across the department, some of them won't be completed by the end of the midterm. They will be carried over to the next step. Yeah. But I don't know if you wanted to say anything with regard to the field gap. I indicated that the DMR is dealing with that, but if you have any information with regard to the processes, I'm going to come back to you, Honorable.
Chair, I concur with your comment on the shell case that there is a DMR mandate at the moment, and we haven't been updated of where it is. But I would like to enter into their mandate. As and when they deal with the matter, they normally invite us to their session. So we haven't had an update yet, but they are dealing with it.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I want the DG to give me a straight answer. Since the last time we've been asking a question about this electricity issue and the project, and I don't remember anybody giving me a straight answer. If you go to Polokwane Municipality, Mangoing, the Hale cluster, I'll talk about the Hale where I come from. All the projects that were helping the people, because they had to get the employment, even if they were not getting the salary, but the stipend. Now they're not working. And I never got a straight answer. Who has the power to instruct ESCOM to allow the project to use a prepaid electricity. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I've indicated that we would like to deal with each and every case, and I would really appreciate if you can give us a list of the projects that have been stopped and the instruction, all of those. I don't want to pass the buck to ESCOM, because ESCOM has its own. One of the issues that the minister recently dealt with in one area in Katlehong is an ESCOM area, and it was around the issue of meters being raised for electricity, ESCOM using its policy, and the minister has been able to intervene. So I would love a situation where you can give us a specific area, honorable member, and I can respond in writing to each and every case and what intervention we will be doing to deal with those issues. As I'm saying, it's a grey area, because some of those projects are mainly managed directly by ESCOM, and ESCOM has a mandate to do so. But as and when there are challenges, whether it's supply, whether it's meter readers, the department, from a policy perspective, is able to respond and intervene in those situations and provide direction in line with and ESCOM itself. So we do have also a working relationship with ESCOM, because some of the work they do it on behalf of DOE. So I would like to get just a written request with specific areas or projects, Chair, and I will have it directly from my office and respond to the honorable member in writing in each and every case how are we going to be handling it moving forward. Where we need ESCOM, we'll engage with them and get a sense of why those projects have been stopped, especially where they affect job creation, because part of the projects we're doing is to enhance job creation opportunities. So we can't be the ones, therefore, not providing the necessary support required for those projects to continue. So I can commit myself to that, Chair, that once I get a written request of those projects, I'll be able to deal with them directly.
I think what we will do is that the difficulty we're having at this committee is that we're dealing with 6 departments and 31 entities. Some of the entities are your entities. In fact, there are entities that we've never met from your own entity because of the time. One is unable to meet with those entities, but also other departments also have the entity. What we normally manage to do is that we meet with all the departments, table there, APP, and also we invite them for their annual report. And to a certain extent, we then invite the entity, but we are unable to meet with system to deal with all the entities. So what we will request, even with the department itself, as you said, you were talking about quarterly reports. We are unable to even have meetings of quarterly reports, but what we'll request is that even if we're not going to invite you to come and present them, but if we could get those quarterly reports. But from the office, we will from time to time also write to you so that you give us information on particular process or the work that you do. They are necessarily inviting you to come and present, including the report that you're talking about on the project. But out of those reports, then we will decide whether we should invite you so that you elaborate on the presentation that is our report that you submitted to us. So that's how, of course, we won't be able, unlike the portfolio committee, they were the only deal with one department and entity. We deal with 6 departments and 31 entities. So from time to time we will then request the phone. So whoever is sending the report to the NA should make sure that our committee secretary also receives the same report, and then they can be circulated to members. It will also assist with regard to the annual report, because we would have tracked what is going on in the department through those quarterly reports.
honorable members, what we're going to do now is to adopt the report. And after adopting the report, then we'll receive the presentation on the IGP and also a presentation of NEFA. And then we're done. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to read the resolution on the adoption of the APP, and then we have a move and a second for the adoption. I'll read it. The Select Committee on Economic and Business Development, having considered budget vote 26, energy, and the annual performance plan 2018-19 of the Department of Energy, reports that it has concluded its deliberation thereof. Report to be considered. So can we have a mover, seconded for the adoption? Honorable Makuwe, seconded by Honorable Tekhale. Thank you very much. So this is going to be ATC, and in terms of our SOP program, we will be having a budget vote page that will led by the minister in the SOP summer. If we could then get the presentation on the two, I don't know which one you're going to get.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We have invited our IPP office, Mr. Maduna, who works with the team on an update that you have requested, to do a quick brief presentation on the update as requested, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. With your permission, I would invite him to take us through the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Chair. Honorable Members. I will take you through the presentation. It focuses mainly on bid window 4. I don't dwell too much into the park, but I'll try and give a high-level overview of where we are and of what happened in the past. Just focusing on the bid window 4 project. There are 24, which include one project from between the 3.5. The total megawatts referred to here is the 2,305 megawatts that is in procured. And this project will connect to the grid in different phases, starting from 2020-2021 to 2022. That's the connection period. The reason for this is that each project gets a connection date from ESCOM in terms of the network availability, and then also they have to pay for that network availability or for the connection cost or build lines themselves. These projects are located in different provinces. It covers about 6 provinces. And they cover different technologies as well. The first technology referred to here is biomass, which is about 25 megawatts, which is a small project. And then 12 of the project is wind projects, which amount to 3,362 megawatts in total. And then the other 12 projects is solar photovoltaic, which amount to 812 megawatts in total, and then also a small hydro, which is about 4.7 megawatts, and then the concentrated solar is about 100 megawatts. Now, just to look at the geographical spread of the projects, 4 projects are located in the Eastern Cape, which is wind project mainly, and then one project, which is the hydro, is in Free State. As you may appreciate, that this is to do with the availability of water. It's located in the runoff river. And one biomass project is in Mpumalanga. We actually believe that Mpumalanga and KZN have potential for biomass, given the resources that's available in those two provinces. Hence, they don't benefit much when it comes to solar and PV. And photovoltaic, we got 4 of them in the Northwest Province, and then we also got 6
should I say, the Northern Cape is the largest beneficiary in this regard. The
also the largest problem.
Also. Okay, yes. They've got a lot of space, I think I should say that.
Lots of potential.
So that's why they could accommodate a lot of projects. So there's wind projects, there are about 6 of them, and there's also 8 solar projects and 1 concentrated solar, which are all located in the Northern Cape. And then we've got 2 projects in the Western Cape, mainly wind projects. Apologize, I should have put a map, it would have shown it much better. Sorry for the font, it's a bit small. But basically, it talks to the point that was raised by members earlier on about South African participation. I think the DG also hit the nail on the head on this one. I think the issue here is that we do have South African participation in the project, but it could be increased. There are a number of reasons. I think the DG has already alluded to this one. As the project stands between the 4 projects, but should I say, starting from between the 1, the South African participation has been increasing on one window to our next window. As it stands today, we're sitting at 57.8% South African owned, which means on average the projects are owned by South Africans. And out of the 26 projects, out of the 26 projects, excluding the solar, the concentrated solar, that's the 57.8, which amounts to 11.9 billion, which means if you own these projects, the 57%, which means they've contributed about 11.9 billion into equity. Now, the concentrated solar is 64% black-owned. I should have said on the first one, the 57% is South African owned. Out of the 57%, out of the 57%, about 57 of that is black owned. It's a confusing reference. So you take the 57%, which is owned by South Africans, and almost half of that is owned by black South Africans. Then the balance is owned by institutional investors, and also state-owned companies that also participate in the program. Institutional investors, I'm referring to your PIC, PIC, DBSA, All Mutual, they all take stake in these projects. But not just on shareholding, we also look at the ownership at throughout the value chain. So we also look at the participation at the construction level, the EPC contractors at the operational level, who own those projects. So we also look at those things to make sure that there's participation across the value chain. When it comes to job creation, we calculated based on the commitment made that the project should provide about 61,000 jobs across the different provinces. Majority of these jobs, we would like to believe that will be for South Africans. About 58,400 of those jobs will be for South Africans. And then majority of them obviously will be in the construction phase. During operation, there will be limited jobs as compared to the total number that is mentioned here. And we also tried to break down the number of jobs per province, taking into account the projects that are located in those provinces. You will see that the Northern Cape is also leading in terms of jobs with 35,363 jobs. And then followed by the Eastern Cape and the Northwest with 8,360. And then after the rest of the other provinces, they share the 7,808. jobs. Then additional jobs are also in the manufacturing sector. We do have a number of manufacturing sites in South Africa. Mainly we do, I think the honorable member referred to towers. We do have a manufacturing site in South Africa for towers, which is in Kuha, But because of the delay, it was closed down. But I understand they intend to resuscitate that process so that we can continue manufacturing for this window. And we also got another one here in the Eastern Cape, manufacturing for towers. And those are the two that I know of that manufacture towers in South Africa. Some they do concrete towers, which they do it on the field itself, which means wherever they want to build the windmill, they also build the concrete tower right there on the field. They don't have to bring it in. But sometimes you will find that the local manufacturing would be struggling with meeting the demand. And if they can't meet the demand, that's where then the problem starts. And as a result, you find that they themselves, they will then say, we can't meet the demand that is required, and therefore we allow these people to import a certain number of towers that we cannot manufacture locally. Just looking at localization in particular, we define localization in a particular way. We exclude certain things from the definition of localization. Localization, we look at key equipment. We don't include, for instance, service fees, like your advisory cost or any other costs that are not part of the definition of localization. And then after we've included that, then what we count as local spend amounts to 22.24 billion rand out of this window. And our calculation is that out of that amount, about 40% of that should go to black-owned enterprise during construction. We also look at what normally happens once the project is being procured. The number of things that happen from a service point of view, which benefits the local community. But equally so, we also see what risk do we take as the state and what risk that we don't take. For instance, in this regard, we don't take any risk related to construction, meaning that the consumer, any cost overrun that happens at the plant during construction, the consumer doesn't carry that. It remains the private sector's risk. And also, the electricity price that gets signed on, it only increases by inflation for the rest of the contract, which is 20 years. So there is no additional cost to the consumer except the price adjustment for inflation. And in addition to that, the consumer or the local community where these projects are located, there's a mandatory requirement for each and every project that they need to contribute socio-economic development to those communities. For these 27 projects, there's 9.8 billion rand of socio-economic development that needs to go to those communities where the projects are located. This money, in most cases, it goes to education, it goes to health, it goes to bursaries, the number of things that are covered by the money. Each project needs to submit a plan every year to say what is it that they will do with the money, and then the department, the office would look at the plan and say, yes, those activities are okay, or those activities are not aligned with your contract that we have signed, which we call implementation agreement. And also there's another amount of money, which is about 3.3 billion rand, which is for enterprise development. So this amount is specifically dedicated to enterprise development, nothing else, and we receive reports on both these amounts every quarter on how they have spent it, and then we also do audit in terms of the actual expenditure of the money and make sure that the money is spent on right activities. Obviously, we do find some non-compliance here and there, and if there's non-compliance, the project gets penalized, and they have to pay penalties for non-compliance. And if you incur more penalties, that could lead even to termination of the contract. To date, if you look at from a carbon emission point of view, there's about 8.1 million tons of carbon emission that isn't displaced by these, or that will be displaced by these 27 projects. Sorry, by the fully operational project, meaning the projects that are in operation already. And, will be placed or displaces 1.8 million tons of carbon emission. Looking at total cost for the project, this project will cost about 55.9 billion rand to build. The DG mentioned that most of the money comes from foreign direct investment, but what they do, they raise the money using their own balance sheet. They will raise it from the local market, but contribute the equity using foreign currency, but you find that most of the time the debt is also raised from the local market. Now, there are a lot of things that we can look at from a money point of view, or how much debt comes from where, but I can say that most of the, or should I say all the commercial banks in South Africa, they are contributing in this regard. They put money into these projects. And I already mentioned the fact that we expect this project to be operational around 2020, which means from 2020 when this project starts being operational, that's when the consumer starts paying. So the consumer doesn't pay upfront. They will have to wait for the energy to be in the grid for them to pay. And that money that needs to be paid to the consumer is not part of the current MYPD, so which means the next MYPD that will cover the year 2020 to 2022 is the one that will have to have the money for these projects. So at the moment there is no contingent liability to government, so government gets exposed to the extent that if Eskom cannot pay for the energy that has been delivered into the grid, then government has the responsibility to pay for that energy, to the extent that the regulator as well doesn't allow that energy to be a pass-through. But the law is clear with regards to the pass-through, and it's clear with regards to the fact that any contract that has gone through a competitive bidding process, that cost for that contract needs to be a pass-through. Operational risk, I think I've already mentioned this one. When I proceed, I think the only point that is not covered here is that this tariff is fixed for the next 20 years. I think I've mentioned as well this one. It's escalated by CPI only. And then construction risk. I've mentioned the construction risk. That's all the risks related to construction are for the private sector, which include cost overrun, time overrun. If you exceed the time that you committed to connect the project onto the grid, you get penalized for that. You lose 2 days for every 1 day late, meaning that your contract gets reduced to that extent that when at some point the contract might be terminated if you still cannot connect it to the grid. If the project gets connected to the grid and you don't meet, let's say for instance it's going to be 25 megawatts, you don't meet the 25 megawatts, then you need to reduce your committed capacity automatically to what you manage to connect into the grid. The number of resources that are required for construction, engineering and procurement, construction, local equipment suppliers. I think I've mentioned earlier on that some of the local suppliers are not sometimes available or sometimes cannot meet the demand, like the tower manufacturing, for instance. And then that becomes a disadvantage because those towers will have to be imported if the local supply industry cannot provide those towers as required by the project. Just to look at the prices roughly, you will realize that the expensive project here is your concentrated solar. The reason for that is because it got storage. You can store the energy in it and release the energy a bit later, so which means it helps with your peak. So during peak demand, this technology can supply you with power. Then you've got also biomass. Biomass it also provides a stable supply using biomass, so it can operate as a base load as compared to wind and PV. And then you will see that wind is the cheapest at the average of 80%. And solar PV is also cheaper, but not as cheap as wind, at average of 1 rand, and small hydro at 338 cents per kilowatt hour. prices are adjusted with inflation, and the actual bid price are much lower than this. These are adjusted prices. The prices as well get affected by the exchange, the foreign currency, because what happens is that until you get to financial close, we take the risk of movement between the different currencies. So, but once we reach financial close, the prices are fixed. We don't take any movement into the rent. So at the moment, some projects have reached financial close, some they hasn't. Those that have reached financial close, the tariffs are fixed. Those that haven't reached financial close, as the rent movement, it affects the price. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you very much. Let me thank the presenter for presenting to us so wonderfully, and also to complain to the presenter. Firstly, I want to know which criteria were they using, Chairperson, when they were selecting these provinces on page 2. I am from Limpopo province. I am representing that province. Before 1994, Chairperson, we used to travel a long distance to go and fetch water in the wild for drinking and then in the dam for doing our washing. And thereafter, the apartheid government came with an idea of a windmill whereby at least we try to have a clean water for drinking and cooking. And that windmill will dry, run dry, even if there's no wind. Limpopo is a sunny area. Mara, they're not appearing here. This is not right here. It can't be right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. A very helpful presentation. The Honourable Dihada just forgot to say that after they've collected the water and then they come to Gauteng to use the electricity. Seriously, Chair, the first one is on the shareholding. We are worried about the lack of transformation within the construction industry and the projections that you're giving to us here. So my question, I will be making more comments again to say that we will, through the Economic Development Department as well as DGI, be monitoring very closely that you indeed meet the standards and targets that you're setting there. The second one is on job creation. Now, coming from Gauteng, you see, I'm not worried about all these other things that they do in the other provinces, because the Honourable Ntebe, who's from Northwest, and myself are at loggerheads when it comes to the utilization of platinum, because the biggest users of the platinum in batteries is a company in Springs in Gauteng. And my question is more related to that particular technology for the storage. I heard you talking about how easy it is to store the energy of solar, but there are other energy sources like the wind and others that you mentioned as well. Maybe my question there would be, would you be the department that's looking at that, or that for under DGI, where you have much more of the manufacturing of the batteries for storage happening? My third comment, Chair, this is a comment. Last year, we visited a plant here in Saldanha, Atlantis. In Atlantis, SEZ, meant to be an SEZ, and it's been legislated already. But there's a big challenge there. That the factory that has been manufacturing blades for the windmill had to pay off more than 360 workers of that small community because they cannot produce on scale. So I thought it's just important, DG, through you, Chair, to mention that there is that capacity there, and one has got to look at. There's a big meeting happening, I think, in the next week in Sodana, where government is looking at revitalizing that industry there. And this is an important industry where we had the painful experience to see 360 people in a fairly rural community losing their jobs. And if we can regain that, it would be good. My final comment would just be, Chair, on the storage as well, that I got to learn recently that Tesla, where this Mark from Cape Town is doing work in the US, is looking at bringing some of that technology to South Africa. Now, they're using it primarily on electronic vehicles, but we are saying that that technology can also be used, if we are creative, in other ways in South Africa. If we look, for example, at one of the big challenges that we have, and I'm dreaming, so I hope that you understand my dream, we cannot have our people die because of fires in informal settlements, and we are not doing anything about it. Those people need energy as well. And we need to look at what are the possibility of providing from these new IPPs energy that is safe and energy that is clean also to people in informal settlements. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let me just indicate that the tea outside told that hot water, and also there are drinks and some muffins. Also, our budget has been also cut drastically, so this is all that we get. So you're free to help yourself here as well, not only for members.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I must say I was having this warm feeling in my heart when the presenter was talking about the Northern Cape, and I saw that every time I sit here with all the other departments, for instance, and we see Northern Cape, and I said, but there's also a problem, you know, and so, okay, but you have the least people there. So thanks to see that we've got six projects on this onshore wind. And it is really good because, as you all know, that the Northern Cape is the poorest province in our country with the largest piece of land, but with no job creation. Now, my question would be is, I see that you estimate, and I would like to know about this, 34,000, I just want to get the exact amount, so 35,363 full-time equivalent jobs. Now, I want to know, will this be during part of construction? Will this be after construction as well? And if you can give me that, because, you know, sometimes it happens, we've seen in the Dar area at some stage, where the Spanish people came and they did this panels, when we went to do oversight there, sun panels, and the people were exploited with the labor laws by just quickly getting jobs there, and the Spanish people did this and they were out again. And after that, these panels are staying there. People are without jobs again. Can you tell me the process of these jobs? And I see, obviously, we're talking about the year 20 to 2022. And then do you have
If it's only in the construction phase, do you have an actual exit plan so that these people can stay in employment somehow?
Honorable Mabuyiwa. And Mr. Shantabulen. On the issue of localization, I heard you saying that you will be spending 22 billion on procurement of goods and services during construction, right? Now, I'm sure we all know that small businesses are drivers of inclusive growth and development in South Africa. Now, here's my question. Have you perhaps, because this money will be spent over time, 2020, 21, 22, and it looks like it's an opportunity, you know, for small black, you know, men and women to enter the energy space. We want that. Now, have you worked perhaps with set down the development of small business to say, look, here is an opportunity so that they can perhaps position themselves, given their mandate to assist emerging black men and women, young men and women, to be ready to benefit from this 22 billion in setting them up into business? I'm asking this because there is a problem in with technocrats. They are not planning together. Each one wants to shine alone and things eventually fall apart. I'll make an example. You have a frustration where municipalities spend a lot of money. In Free State now, as we're speaking, there are 16,844 plus toilets. Millions were spent on that, 27 million, almost 2 billion were spent to build those toilets. But because they didn't plan together with the Department of Water and Sanitation, you know what happened? They realized now that they do not have the bulk water rectification to, you know, to make those toilets flush and run. Those toilets are sitting there, standing empty, money, millions, and billions were spent on that. Now, Water Affairs is only coming late now, and they're having their own problems. They didn't plan together. So you've got that problem. So I'm asking this so that I can get a sense how you're working, so that if there's a problem, we can nip it in the bud. Because planning together with other relevant stakeholders, it helps. And I've made this example of the money you're ready to spend. And I'm thinking now, small business development, are they aware of this? Are they ready to assist the black folks who want to enter the energy space to supply those goods and services? And thank you, sir.
Thank you. Honorable Kevin.
On a lighter note, I've been asking Mavosana what does he understand with the new code now, full-time equivalent jobs. You know, technocrats, every time you come to our meetings, you come with new terms. I want us to speak about things that we can touch and feel. Now, as committees, we went, and I want to give you a classical example. We went to the Northern Cape. 1,400 solar panels erected. Community members were on our doorstep saying to us, "We've not been able to reap at micro level the benefits as SMEs in this project." They said to us, into our face. That's what we came back and we said, DG, that is what we call the Spanish invasion. Spaniards are in the Northern Cape, big farms, erected solar plants, communities are not benefiting. And each and every time we get a presentation, everything is rosy. There's a commitment that 40% will be spent on SMEs and cooperatives, and this is never, at whatever given moment, quantified into things that we can touch and feel. The same presentation is saying to us, there's a commitment. Now, a commitment, we know that partners, stakeholders commit and they don't live up to their commitment. This, learning from the experience of the Northern Cape, how different is it going to be? You also speaking about your full-time equivalent jobs, but you're not addressing the issue that has already been on the space, in the national space, about job security. This goes beyond the full-time equivalent jobs. It goes beyond that. Job security, which has been a contentious issue, which is also part of the litigation process that we've seen around. Now, to this day, we know that this is a contested terrain, and your presentation is not addressing it. How do you ensure that industrial peace, insofar as those issues are concerned, is being secured, but also going beyond that, as Honorable Faber was saying, are you talking about jobs that are going to be created in the immediate, or jobs that are going to be created in the future? Because this cannot be just a replacement of one form of energy with another without checking the variables that are at play. And this is one thing that we want to see from the DG, from the presentation. And the presentation is valid. The presentation also talks about 57% South African ownership. Now, I can tell you what you are calling institutions that are, what was that number, that institutional? You said some are coming from the SOE, some are coming from institutions. In these committees, we call them the DFIs. We call them the Development Funding Institutions. For a particular reason, that in the main, what they seek to do is to make sure that they contribute to the development of the country. That is silent. So if you have PICs, you have Developmental Bank of South Africa, you have all these contributing, we would want to hear that development trajectory that they should be pursuing. And development cannot be absent from job creation and job security for that matter. So these are the things, and Chair, probably if you allow, we must have this presentation of IPPs under the radar so that we can follow it up. But so far, from where I'm sitting, I think we just scratching the surface. Because we need to be able to speak to issues that, as I said, the things that we can touch and feel. The 57% that you are speaking of, also, if I understood you well, you are saying from the 57%, 64% of it. That's why you were saying you are speaking very awkward statistics. 64% of it is black-owned. Maybe I'll read it later. But that's very weird, because I'm trying to do my Bantustan economics and mathematics. There's something that I can't get. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Perhaps before you respond, I suggest that we should also get a report with the details on the issues that are raised by members. So that the report is not at a high level, but also it deals with the final details. For example, I would like a report that first talks to the fully operational projects in each province, but also in the province where these projects located, but also each project, the issue of ownership also be broken down. Foreign shareholding, local shareholding, black shareholding, but also another one on the potential operation, projects that are not yet fully operational. But also in each of these projects, each of the provinces must also to talk to what role are these projects playing with regard to community development. The point that Honorable Tele is raising with regard to Northern Cape. But also a comparison in terms of what the households are paying currently and compared to what they would be paying when these projects are operational.
can respond on the issues that how did you address those issues that they raised? Because I know one of them is the issue of job creation or job losses. But also if you can talk to each one of those projects, whether compared to job losses and job creation, whether if, for example, currently there are so many workers that are unemployed, how many workers, I mean, jobs will these projects create compared to the jobs that are currently in place? Those kind of responses. The DC was talking about, he acknowledged the fact that these are mainly the shareholders, mainly will be foreign in terms of the amount of money. But then he talked about engaging Treasury with regard to funding mechanism. Given that already there is a cut in the budget of the department, is it possible then for the Treasury to come to the party with regard to this project to ensure that there is a South African participation in this project, given the state of financial constraints or fiscal constraints in the country? Those are the questions that I ask you to respond to. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members, for the questions and also the input. To start with the issue about the criteria, why some provinces didn't get, especially we do have projects in the previous round in Limpopo, but obviously I don't think there are as many as compared to the Northern Cape. I think the reason is that most of the project or the project developers, they choose the area. We don't choose the area. They go and study the area and see whether there's potential for what they intend to do, because they take the risk. If the project doesn't produce enough energy, they lose, because we only pay for the energy. We don't give them money to build it. We say build it. If it generates and feed in energy into the grid, we pay for the energy. So they go and look for an area that will be producing enough energy to suffice the investment.
It's not only right in Limpopo. In the Northern Cape, it stays there alone.
But having said that, I think we thought about a number of things in terms of how do we make sure that there's a distribution spread across the different provinces. And if you look at Limpopo, for instance, you do have coal, which I think we got coal IPP there, which will also contribute. KZN, you got biomass, which will also contribute. But I suppose there could be other mechanism which you could structure the program in such a way that you try and incentivize people to go to certain areas. But that requires thinking and also acceptance of the fact that if you do that, it might come at a cost as well, because it would not be the cheapest, necessarily cheapest source of energy, but driven by trying to spread the project across. The issue about black participation, shareholding into the project, I think the DG made the point. I think we need to find a better funding mechanism in terms of how do we fund it. This also deals with the other question about the institutional investors. For instance, if you look at PIC, for instance, they would borrow you money, but they also need to take stake. So they don't give you money and then stay aside. So it's like we give you money, but we also want to be in the project. So it's like you then spread the cake. The cake, because they don't want to give you money and stay away, because they're saying we're also investors and we're
money of the pensioners, so we need to be there and understand what's happening on the project, so we can't just give money and run away. So you also got those issues. Obviously, institutions like DBSA, IDC, I think there is a need to sit down and discuss some of these things and also the funding terms, so that at least we can have a better way of providing funds to black individuals or black companies in such a way that they become equal partners into the project. The DG made the point that if you allow international funders to come in or investors to also support our policies in some way, they will then, you know, you don't have much power, leverage, because the money doesn't belong to you. So, and I think we need to work on that in such a way that the policy of having black people participating into these contracts is also supported by the necessary resources. It's true, in Antarctica, because the program was not moving, I think we didn't have any project for the past 2 years or 2-3 years. So as a result, some of the factories, they closed down because the pipeline was no more there. But I think we need to have a program that would not have a stop start, because I think the stop start is what causes the factories to close down, so that the factories could sustain themselves and also they can be in a position to start exporting these products. I know in Antarctica, I think they're already there. They are exporting some of the products. They're not just supplying for South Africa, but they also export some of those products. And once a factory got to that level of maturity, it becomes easy to sustain. Even if we don't procure, they can still survive by exporting product to other countries. Storage and Telsa, yes. We are very excited about storage because we think it will change the electricity or the energy landscape in South Africa. If we can have storage, you can also do off-grid electrification. You can also do a lot of things. You don't need to have grid in each and every household if you've got storage. You can have your panel, including your battery, and supply that particular household. So we are very keen to look at this, and also the fact that if you've got storage and if you've got enough electricity during the day, you can store it coming from your wind and PV, you can store it and release it later at night. We think it's a very good thing to look at. As an office, we do a lot of consideration with regards to storage to see where is storage going, but we do accept that at this point, batteries are not necessarily the cheapest, but the prices are falling very quickly. So we shouldn't lose sight because very soon we think storage will be where PV and wind is. Because a few years ago, PV was very expensive, but today it's one of the cheapest technologies. With regards to jobs, we can split the jobs with regards to which ones belong to construction and which ones belong to operations. Like I said, most of them, they belong to construction, but we can provide a report, according to Chair, that explains this in more details. We thought we needed to summarize and just give a high-level overview of what's happening. The last time when we were in the PCE, we presented almost 2 hours trying to present everything, starting from between the one to where we are. We do have that information and we can provide it accordingly. Engaging with small businesses, I think it's something that we should do. We are engaging at the local government level, but I think we also need to engage at national level with small businesses. I think it's a well-made point, and I think we need to take this one seriously going forward, so that we try and harmonize the activities. I don't think we're doing enough there. With regards to jobs, the definition of jobs. There are a number of definitions out there, and we try to make sure that the way we define jobs, we are defining it in a way that we can monitor it. For instance, we don't necessarily count heads, but we count hours performed, and then we combine the hours. So because you can have 1,000 people today and you don't have them tomorrow, that does not necessarily mean you hired 1,000 people according to our definition. We would divide the hours and say that it's equivalent to 3 jobs, for instance, because you had 1,000 people for one day, you know. So we divide the hours in such a way that we count them 8 hours a day for 1 year, and we say, okay, that we can regard it as a job. But if it doesn't make 1 year, 8 hours a day, it's not a job in our view. So you need to add it up. So you can have a lot of people during a particular period and have less people during a particular period, but when we add it up, all of it, it should give us the number that you committed to perform. Yes, benefit at local government level. We engage with a lot of communities around the project. If there are issues and if there are concerns, we normally go to the ground and engage and try and understand what's happening to those projects. Obviously, there is an issue about when we refer to local, because when people procure activities, they refer South Africa as local, but not necessarily at a particular project. You know, you find that the equipment, whatever they procure is in Joburg, not necessarily at the project, and then the community will have issues with that. Say, but we can also do the same thing. Why do you have to go and get somebody from outside of the community? And I think those are issues that we are grappling with, and we try our best to engage and try and facilitate should we receive such consent. But what we thought we should do in future is that we need to try and separate what needs to be spent in the local communities where the projects are located and what could be spent nationally. Because I think that's where the problem starts. You find that more expenditure is happening at a national level as compared to at a local level. So it's an issue that we have taken note of, and I think going forward, we believe that there are a lot of things that if we were to design another window, we need to improve on it. Such as, for instance, this window doesn't have that. In the past, we used to have what we call 50-kilometer radius. Say, your socio-economic development must be spent within the 50-kilometer radius, not outside of that. And we also receive a lot of concerns about that, because, like, where do you draw the line, you know? It's one district, one municipality, some people are getting, some they're not getting, you know? So we try to deal with that on this round of procurement, but going forward, there are other things that we think need to be addressed to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistake. Job security, we believe that the reason why the program was designed the way it was designed, to have different windows, not to procure everything in one go, procure it in different windows, it helps you to provide security to the jobs. Because today you are constructing this power plant, next year it's another one, and next year it's another one. And these are small power plants, like 100 megawatts a year. So it helps to sustain the employment rather than you finish with construction and then everyone can go home, you know. But if you've got another project that's coming the following year, you move people from this project to another project, then it sustains, it provides security on the jobs as well. But what we have observed is that we also got companies, South African companies, that are now doing developmental work even in the region, even outside of South Africa. And that's what we believe empowerment it means. So that you have our own local black companies that are starting to venture the SADC or the African market. Because there's a lot of potential for energy in Africa, and if we can get our companies active and good enough to go out there and also do work in those countries, I think that would be a good thing to do. We do have one or two companies that are doing that already, but our view is that we need to train more, we need to have more companies that will also go and participate in Africa. I think I've addressed the job creation today and the future.
arrange formal engagements with those institutions, but some of the matters that were raised through the court process were also attended through answering affidavits by the department in dealing with those issues to make sure that there's a common understanding. But I don't think we would like to use the court process as the new platform to deal with some of these issues. We are engaging with the affected parties moving forward. There are set meetings. We are also expecting to receive memorandum from COSATU as well, where they'll be outlining some of their concerns, upon which then we will be dealing with those issues at the level of DOE, obviously working with the IPP office. So we have taken cognizance of the concerns that have been raised, but we will be getting also a formal written memorandum whereby they will outline all the issues for further engagement. So we are taking quite seriously the concerns that have been raised in the public space.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think that our chair had indicated early on that what would happen on these legal matters and other developments is that as soon as you are able to share that with us, you will indeed do so. We will appreciate that. Can we go to the next final presentation, which is from NERSA? Please, sir.
What does the Electricity Regulation Act say about
when we're setting the electricity prices and tariffs, so we have to regulate the prices and tariffs. But it also says that we must enable an efficient licensee, and I think efficient is the key word. And what is efficient? And we must allow that licensee to recover the full cost of its license activities, including a reasonable margin or a return. But we must also ensure that they avoid undue discrimination between customer categories. And we may also permit cross-subsidization between tariffs. So the application we're talking about today is the ESCOM average tariff, which is their revenue allocation. And then the next step to that is where they develop the tariff to recover that revenue. And we are allowed to permit some cross-subsidization there. And we must also issue rules around, how we implement the government's electricity policy framework, the IRP, and the Act. So slide number six really is the crux of what we do. So everybody talks a lot about the price increase, but when we talk from a regulatory perspective, we actually talk about the allowable revenue. And we don't talk about how much should we increase their price from 1 year to the next. We talk about how much revenue do they need to cover their expenses, which is the big E there. And then what is the value of the property, plant and equipment employed in the activity that you regulate, not everything that they own. What would the depreciation be on that? And then what is the working capital they need to perform the operation? And there are those three in brackets, which is the value of the plant, less the depreciation, plus any working capital. We apply a return to that, a WACC, weighted average cost of capital, which is essentially so how much of the money that you use is equity and how much is debt, and what is the cost of the debt and what is the cost of the equity. And you get a weighted there, and the current, we differ a bit from ESCOM, but we peg the weighted average cost of capital at around 12%. They say it's more like 18, but we use 12 in our calculations, and that's the nominal figure. Real is something more like 6 to 8%. So they get a return on the capital employed as well as their property, plant and equipment. And then we've got the RCA, which is not part of this particular decision because there was no RCA. We're busy doing those applications at the moment. And that should actually be a plus or minus, not just a plus. So where they've actually been given more money than what they needed to spend, they would actually have their next decision modified by that to be reduced. But I don't think we've ever had a negative there, always positive. So then we look at the allowable revenue, and I'll get to the table now, but it's somewhere around, I think it was 190 billion that we said they could collect in this financial year. If you divide that by the number of units of electricity that they say they will sell, or that we forecast that they will sell, we agreed to, then you get to the average price per unit. So that's slide 7, I'm not going to go into, it's really just a bit of a write-up on each of those elements I've just spoken about. Maybe the one there that isn't covered in the slide before is this thing around integrated demand management costs, and those are the things like the energy efficiency, the demand side management initiatives, and in the current decision for this year, we didn't allow any of that, given that they have surplus energy, so you're not trying to get people to use less in the current environment. So slide number 8 is really the crux of the matter, which is the decision that we made. ESCOM applied for 219 billion in revenue, and you'll see we've got A in brackets, the second line, which is the revenue they derive from the special agreements. The agreements that some of them, which were legacy agreements, which we don't approve, we just carried through, and then the revenue under the third line, which is B, that is the actual revenue that we talk about that is recovered from the rest of the customers, the normal customers in the country, and they applied there for 206 billion rand, and we awarded them 176. So we reduced what they claimed or they wanted to claim for by about 30%, and then they said they would sell about 192,000 gigawatt hours, which is 192,000 or a million kilowatt hours. A kilowatt hour is the unit that you normally build on in your home or as a business. We reduced that, or they reduced it themselves actually, updated the application, and while we were doing the public hearing, to say they're revising their forecast down because they're looking at what the current sales are. So we accepted that, to say, okay, we accept that you're actually going to only sell about 188, what we call terawatt hours, in this year. And then if you divide the B by the C, so B is the revenue that will be collected from standard customers, and C is the amount of units of energy, you get the 93.79 cents per kilowatt hour, which is the average tariff, the average cents per kilowatt hour. And that worked out to a 5.23% increase from the previous year's tariff. They applied for 19.9. So, as I said, we don't look at the increase per se as a percentage, we look at what revenue would we allow them and how much sales will they make, and then when we do the division, we get a number, and then the percentage increase comes out from whatever the previous year was to what we're going to allow them. So I think one of the things, and we'll talk about it a bit later very quickly, is that if you look at it for the current, the past year, sorry, not the current year, we're already in the new financial year, we actually allowed Eskom, I think it was 205 billion rand to be collected. And then they were looking for 219. So overall, we allowed them 190. So if you look at it, we're allowing them for this year 15 billion rand less than what we allowed them for last year. Not to say they collected all of it, and that, I think, is one of the big problems we have currently. Slide number 9 really just tells you the big areas where we made adjustments on the application were in the expenditure, which is the operational expenditure, which includes all the manpower costs, etc. The primary energy, which is about a 10 billion rand reduction, which is the coal cost, but also open cycle gas usage, etc. And I've got a slide on each of these, which I'll just run through quickly. And then also on the IPP purchases, which you've just been discussing, those, Verunda 3.5 and 4, as you can see from that slide, those projects will only come into operation in 2021. So in this particular revenue window, which is 18-19, none of those projects were coming in. So therefore, the 7.6 billion in purchases that would have been allowed as a pass-through was then deducted from the application. And then also the depreciation, which I'll talk about a bit later, which we reduced because some of the assets that are being employed are not the most efficient. In other words, they're using more expensive plants than they needed to produce electricity when they had other plants available. So if we go to slide 10, we thought this would be quite interesting to say that 93.79 cents, how is that broken down? What are the cost buckets? So I think something quite interesting and topical given the presentation you just had is that in terms of the current IPP agreement signed, is 13 cents of that 93, so 13 cents of every unit sold is for IPP purchases. So those are really pass-through costs for Eskom. And then you can see the primary energy is quite a big part of that, which is 23 cents of those 93, and then the expenditure. So those are the big buckets. Now, if we, slide number 11 really is just a percentage. So that cents made into a percentage. And what I really want us to look at is slide number 12, which is around the primary energy. And it's one of the big areas where we made quite a large adjustment. So what we did, if you look at that top line, which is called coal usage. Now, what we did with Eskom is we said they've got a station called Arnett, which is their most expensive coal-fired power station. So the coal for that station is the most expensive coal that they buy. Now, what they've done is they spread the requirements for supply across their coal station. What we said to them is, look, if you're an efficient licensee, you should be utilizing your most cheapest plant to its fullest extent before you go to the next one. So for the purposes of calculating, and that's why I'm saying, I know it's said in the media we're telling Eskom to close these power stations down. We're not saying that. We're saying in terms of efficiency of cost, we took the most expensive coal energy out and we replaced it with available cheaper coal energy in their mix. And we said to them, so you should be spending 39 billion, etc., not 49, on coal. But you need to go and optimize the way you run your operation. This other one, net coal obligation, I think is quite an interesting one. Is that an obligation they have? So for Medupi and Kusile, because the bills arrived late and they came into operation late, they had coal commitments. And they therefore then had to pay these coal obligation, essentially penalties. We've disallowed it. because we're saying, well, if you bring it in late, you know, you can't penalize the consumer now to pay for the penalties you incur. Then you'll see the OCGTs, which is, it's about 8 lines up, OCGT fuel cost. We reduced that by half, by about 300 million, because what Eskom had set that at was a 1% utilization factor. But historically, in the last year, they've only used it at a 0.5%, so we pegged it at that. That they only use it because they do need it sometimes during the peak, because it's part of your mix to supply in an optimal way. Nuclear, we disallowed some of, I think it was storage costs from nuclear. And this is not for the new build, this is the current operation. As I said, IPPs. And so overall, primary energy, the previous slide said about 10 billion. So this includes others like the OCGTs and nuclear and all these others. So we reduced that by about 20 billion overall on primary energy. The other one was what we call expenditure. Now, we're saying employee benefit costs, we reduced by about 3.8 billion. And I'm not sure if we've sent you our reasons for decision documents, but we can do that, Chair. So in there, you'll see we indicate to Eskom, look, you know, there's a lot of this stuff around the World Bank study, which they refuted recently, to say that, you know, they have a lot more staff than what they need to run the operation of the current size. So we looked at the World Bank study, and we said, look, it was Latin America, et cetera, so we can't use it directly. But what we did was we said to Eskom, we're going to benchmark you against ourselves. Let's take 2007, before all of the issues happened with load shedding, and how much energy were you producing per staff member that you employed? And it was around 5.2 gigawatt hours per, 7 point something gigawatt hours per employee that they were producing. The current application said, well, they're going to produce 5.2 gigawatt hours per employee. So it says, well, you've had almost, like a third reduction in productivity, technically, if you look at it on paper. But yes, they've got the ball program, et cetera, so you have staff in areas that aren't in areas where electricity is being produced today. But we said to them, we want to hold you to that other efficiency standard. So we said, okay, we're going to take that, and we say, well, your staff should be, we worked out about 6,000 odd staff less, you should take the 2007 efficiency level. And we said, okay, so we're going to adjust your cost by a percentage so that you need to start bringing efficiencies in. Now, we're not saying go and reduce the number of staff, and we're not saying reduce the salaries, et cetera. What we're saying to Eskom is, this is the efficient line. If you want to go and operate inefficiently, that's for your own cost. Don't make the consumer pay. That will come out of your return, out of your bottom line. That's where a lot of the the decisions we make are. We say that's the efficient level. If you want to do above that, go do it. But then we're not allowing the consumer to pay for it. You must pay for that out of your own pocket. And then also on maintenance, we reduce because that's in transmission. Distribution, it looks like, oh, you know, maintenance, but why we reduce some of that is because the submissions they've made in the past, they haven't actually spent all the money we've allowed them. So we're saying don't ask for it up front. If you do happen to spend it and you can prove that it's prudent and efficient, you will come in the adjustment mechanism, which is the regulatory clearing account, which would be the following year. So don't make people pay in advance. Come and ask for it after you've done it. Okay. So depreciation, again, as we said, Endrina and Arnott are expensive stations, and actually they didn't need to be utilized in this mix if you were to put the mix together, and therefore we're not going to allow them to include it in the asset base that they will earn a return on, or depreciation. So we took that out, and we adjusted the depreciation they were allowed. I think this is something that really, we talk about why do they need to make these big adjustments every time, like now they're asking over 3 years for 66 billion of adjustments. If you look at that blue line, that is what the forecasts have been since 2006. And the red line is the sales they actually achieved. Now, if you keep forecasting these higher sales, it means your average price seems lower for those years, but you're not collecting all the revenue you allow. And then you take the red line and say, well, your sales are flat. That's why they're coming back and saying, we've been 10% out every year, please give us that money back in the following year. And then that's where we came to what we call utility debt spiral, right? Is if your sales volumes are flat and your costs are going up, you'll see that light blue line is the one that says, well, that's the price. And okay, so we've expanded. So if you zoomed out, the doctor line would be relatively flat from 2012. But we wanted to zoom in to see, and you can see, so we're saying, yeah, your sales are declining, your price is increasing, and as the sales decline, the price has to increase more and more at a faster rate to recover the same revenue. Okay, so that's what the death spiral is about. At some point, you have a cliff where effectively, no matter how much you raise your price, the dark blue line is going to drop so far down, you still will never recover the revenue that you need to run your operation. Something that concerned us, as we said, is in terms of revenue analysis from the 13 up to 2017, which was the first 4 years of the last multi-year price determination, Eskom had under-recovered revenue by about 10% every year. So you're talking at the current revenue allocation around 20 billion a year that they just don't get to recover because they can't make the sales that they had forecast. So you'll see in the decision we made for the 1 year, the sales forecast has been changed quite significantly to reflect the current condition. Instead of the 200 odd, it's 188 terawatt hours. Another area that concerns us is that if you look at slide 18, you'll see our decision, you'll see the actual expenditures and the variances that, especially on primary energy, and maybe not in the last year or so, but before that, Eskom was expending 35%, 23% more than what we had allowed them in the decision. The operating costs have been more or less what we allowed them, and then the CapEx is a big area where they've been spending way more than what they had in the plans that we had approved. And where it comes in is not to say that maybe it's spending more, some of it could be cost overrun, but if Eskom is spending more money than what we had allowed for in the decisions, it means they've had to borrow more money. And we allow them a certain amount of money to repay debt. So where is the other money coming from to repay this? And so we calculated that they've spent about 72 billion rand more than what was in the applications of those previous years. Where's the interest servicing money coming from? The other thing is, if you look at the application for this 1 year, is they estimate to spend, I think it's 60-odd billion rand in capex. Now, only 42 billion of that or so is regulatory asset-based capex, which we would allow them to cover with customer money to pay that debt. The other 20-odd is other projects. And that's going to come either out of their bottom line or they're going to have to get shareholder support for that. So that's another area that they have to look at. And that's, I think, partially where they've run into some of these cash problems because they haven't been able to access the debt market. I think it's changing now and improving. So just conclusions are, you know, the view on this 1 year application is, so Eskom, and they've done it almost every year, they failed to collect all the revenue we've allowed them. And yes, they say there are other reasons, etc. Economic conditions, incorrect forecasting. But then they've also had expenditures that exceeded what we've allowed them. So you've got a double whammy coming in. And we're saying we've seen as these tariffs have increased, we've seen decreases in consumption, and that's what everybody at the public hearings have been telling us. As you increase, I'm going out of business, they're going to sell this. We need to do something about it. So they're in a vicious cycle, we believe. The only way for them to break that is to reduce their costs, and it's not only the variable. You know, the honest Andrina coal that we've said you need to look at optimizing, but also their fixed costs. You know, and if they can do that, it means that they reduce their cost base. That means tariff increases are smaller, and then hopefully you can start to get more consumption, which will bring the prices down even more, you know, and you can start to increase your revenue as you go. We were asked a question by the other committee, the portfolio committee, as to so what, you know, there's all these issues. But in the reason for decision, which we'll make a note to think, we've given them the roadmap. We've actually said to them, these are the things we need you to do going forward, and we'll monitor that as we go. And just as we said, that particular document I think we've done now, this RFD, which I've actually got here, but this is the confidential version, it's 118 pages. In the decision. Our decisions of the past have actually been 40 or maybe 50, even for a multi-year. So we've tried to go into real detail here to show them where are the areas we need to look at. Obviously they don't agree with us on everything, and we're happy we'll engage with them. And then as we go through now, the previous 3 years, not this last one, the years before that, of the multi-year price determination, they've obviously made an application to adjust that revenue. And we're busy doing those public hearings at the moment, which is why some of our members couldn't be here. But and I just wanted to, I suppose it's a marketing thing for the members. So we're in Kimberley on the 3rd of May, with that public hearing, in Bloemfontein on the 4th, Nelspruit on the 7th, Polokwane on the 9th, and then Gauteng in Soweto on the 11th. And if members are around, we'd really be happy if you could attend and you could see, you know, how we run these and what are the issues that are brought out. Chair, thanks. That's all I have today.
Thank you very much. Maybe if you can also send us the list of the public hearings.
We do.
Okay. Can we then get an opportunity to ask questions? Maybe the last one on the conclusion. Isn't the if I may start, isn't it the crux of the matter, the fact that the ESCOM is unable to collect revenue? And also, what is your view, say, if the ESCOM were to directly charge the households and other users rather than going through the municipalities? Because some of the municipalities, they take the money and use it for their operation instead of handing it over to ESCOM. For me, if this area were to be addressed, this one of the revenue collection, I don't think from time to time ESCOM would come to you for the tariff increase. The other point for me is to what extent are these governance issues relate to the fact that affect the bottom line of ESCOM, and we are paying for those for the mismanagement. The next one is you just told us the methodology that you use. In my mind, I'm just thinking, what effect do these public hearings have? Already you have a methodology that you focus on. Would these public hearings change you from using that methodology? Because most of the time in the public hearings, people are just going to focus on the socio-economic impact of the tariff increase. They won't be focusing on those on the methodology that you use or that you use to arrive at whether you should give the increase or not. But the last one is whether in your consideration, especially of the public hearings, whether you should not also be looking at the provinces, because provinces are also not required in terms of their socio-economic data. Are you allowed to say in a particular province this will be the increase in terms of the tariff, which is different from the next province, and so on? Thank you, Honorable. Honorable Faba, Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the insightful presentation. Yes, I've seen that OTA, for instance, said that ESCOM's operating costs could have been 85 billion lower for the financial year. Now that is quite a lot. To say for the, I almost want to say the godog of the taxpayer. And I want to know, there should be some type of accountability. You were saying to us that there was a roadmap previous. This time your roadmap is a much bigger map. I hope they use Google Maps or something there, because it seems that someone got lost on the previous roadmap. But surely there must be accountability. And I would like to know, the accountability, is that just replacing a board? It cannot just be
accountability like that. I would like to know, do you give suggestions on accountability of what has to happen to get this rotten core out of the management or someone paying for it? I don't know. It's just a question I would like from your side. And I really am glad to see that you are not budging under pressure. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is a bit of a difficult question to formulate, but I'm looking at what has been presented to us earlier on about the IPPs and now ESCOM. So my question has two elements. Because the IPPs, many of them, although the schedule is in 2020-2021, some of them are operational already. Now that the minister has signed the IPPs, it means that they can supply into the ESCOM grid. Can you tell us if that is going to have an impact? Are you going to, as NERSA, look at the performances of those IPPs, or are you going to look at them via the eyes of ESCOM? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Two things really from the presentation I want to raise. You have indicated in your presentation that it appears that ESCOM, in fact, we have evidence that ESCOM has continuously erred when it comes to their sales focus, hence the revenue shortfall when it comes to collection. Secondly, you seem, or through your presentation, it comes out that you have indicated that ESCOM always spends more than we have allowed them to do so. Now, here is my question: by law, do you think you do not have a right? Or I'm trying to think, how can, if they spend more than the decision you have made, they spend more than you've allocated them, you've allowed them to do so. You don't have monitoring mechanisms that you could put in place to ensure that this, doesn't recur, or because it looks like it has happened over a number of years, or you've been struggling with the mandate or legislation was limiting you, because we want to look at this thing so that as lawmakers we can see if probably you feel that you do not have the right by law to do so, so that then you can consider, legislating in this issue, so that there could be checks and balances, because it cannot be allowed that ESCOM can, because it is the ordinary gogo who pays the price. It is the ordinary South African who pays the price for all this, that ESCOM is plunging us into. So I want to just know if you think that you cannot monitor them and bring them to line, and if so, do you think this legislation is limiting you to that extent? Then we'll see how we can intervene. Thank you, Chair.
I think, firstly, I would want to establish whether there's appetite on the part of ESCOM to... I hear you saying that you don't agree on the 180 pages, the recommendations that you're giving, but you are ready to engage. Is there appetite on their part to accede council that they should be able to follow those guidances? I'm raising this because your conclusion summit is very explicit. I think that tariff increases in their name, they eat or erode consumption. Consumption that's leading to consumers' issues of affordability can be a problem, particularly under conditions where South Africa finds itself today in a stagnant environment and operating from a fiscal cliff. Now, I think you were also explicit that if we continue to follow the current funding model, that you only fund them for what they have been able to spend and they can be able to account for. It means that ESCOM will never be able to service its debt. And in the event there's a shortfall, they should go seek for some other financial means. So this is something that is very troubling, but is there any appetite to arrest the situation? If not, what is it that NERSA in the immediate is seeking to do? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Over to
you. Thank you, Chair. It's almost like, I mean, apparently when we do our hearings and it's like 30 questions after we speak. So I think I've had a lot of practice in the last week. So I think the first one was about, you know, Eskom being unable to collect the revenue and the view on whether if they were to directly charge customers instead of having a municipality in between. So, we've had that request a lot from customers. We actually have, I think there was, I forget the name of the community and in which area, but we just recently had a representation that said to us, you know, there's a community that wants to buy directly from Eskom because they've got issues with the municipality, they pay the municipality, and then the municipality doesn't do what they're supposed to, and they actually pay Eskom. So, I don't know, I don't have a personal view on that. I just think if Eskom were to do all of that logistically, it would be almost impossible for them to do. I mean, they're struggling to do what they're doing at the moment. Where we do have a challenge, I guess, as a regulator, is, or not a challenge, but where we do have some leverage is when we approve, and that's what we'll be doing now very shortly, is the municipal tariff increases. There is a requirement that they ring-fence the money. At the moment, they don't. I mean, it goes into a big pool. They're also required to spend at least 6% on maintenance, and that must go into an account. So we are starting to take them on about those. If they want to spend more money and they want to increase the tax, so the current municipal increase, the guideline that we give them based on this 5.23% is 6.84. So if they want anything more than that, they have to come and tell us what they're going to do. We also then say to them, look, if you're going to collect this money, you need to report back to us on how you spent it and where you put it. They don't always do that, but I mean that's an ongoing battle between the regulator and these entities. The thing about not paying the electricity bills, etc., I think that is an ongoing challenge, and Eskom has indicated to us they do come and report to us periodically. It also talks to, I must get all the terminology right, but you know, the equitable share and also working with Treasury. So we also work with Treasury now and again. They ask us for the info we've got in terms of, you know, which are the areas that haven't paid, you know, or that are in arrears to a certain extent. We also indicate, we also then send warning letters to municipalities. And I think this talks to a further question is, so what are our powers? One of the powers is it's the license condition. So we say, you're in contravention of your license conditions, you're not maintaining your network. We then have a filing against them, we then form a tribunal, which is a requirement of the Act. We then have a filing against whoever the licensee might be, and we give them, I think it's, I could be wrong, but it's 30 or 60 days to correct. If they don't, then the power we have is to fine them, I think it's 10% of revenue or 2 million rand a day. But I mean, if you do that, you make things worse there. So we actually try to work with them to improve what they do. And I'll talk about the legislative thing when we get to that. There is some issue there that we could possibly look at. The governance issues and to what extent is this actually. So we're an economic regulator. We get asked that a lot. And actually, who was it? ALSA? You know, they ask us a lot and say, why have you not gone and done this? There are agencies and institutions and even the shareholder that does that stuff. Where we indicate we are able to hold them to account for that. So, for example, if you look at the coal costs, which I think is a big area of contention, we had a decision we made in 2013 where we benchmarked the coal costs. In this current decision that we're talking about here today, we then escalated that by a composite index, which includes coal price escalation or cost escalation, and it's made up of a percentage of that and PPI or CPI. And we said, okay, so if we escalate that benchmark to where we are today, what should the price be? Okay, and then what is the price you're asking for, and we're holding you to the efficient price. The rest could be, I'm not saying it is, but it could be to do with the governance issues.
But if we're saying, come back and prove to us that that difference in maybe the next RCA was not because of other inefficiencies. Prove that you were efficient, that you still need an extra whatever. So that's how we do it. We do it from an economic perspective, but we're not those other types of agents. The other one was the methodology. Yeah, people say we pay lip service, the people come and they talk to us and we just say, yeah, yeah, and we just carry on. So the methodology is there in terms of the cost bucket, but how we determine whether a cost bucket is appropriate or not is that part of the discussions we're having. So, for example, we even have some of the big customers that come to the public hearings and then they lament. And I asked one of them the other day, I said to them, so you know that there's an option if you talk to us in the department gives us a framework for a special agreement. And it's not like a bulletin type agreement. This is an agreement that says, well, this is the framework under which we might be able to assist an entity that's possibly going out of business to stay in business. But if they cover all the fixed, the variable costs plus some of the fixed costs, and maybe they don't pay the cross subsidy, they can stay in business, but they reduce the average price because you're selling more electricity. Okay, and apparently they tell us, every time they tell us they are working on that. But we also listen to, and you talk about the gogos, and we listen to them because they tell us what, and maybe it's not to do with this particular average price application, but the next step is the retail tariff. And to say, okay, so, and I can then possibly address the other one about, you know, we can't set tariffs for provinces. But what we can do is when the municipalities come to us and they ask us for a price increase, and we've got certain, we do benchmarking at the moment for different levels of consumption. We are moving to cost of supply, which is a lot more detailed, so we can work out what is their cost of supply, and then we, but at the moment we do benchmarking, and we say to them, okay, so you want to charge the prepayment customer at a lower level beyond a certain amount. Why? Because it's outside our benchmark, and they need to come and justify that, and we can. So if we've had a Google or somebody from that province that came to us and said, you know, these people, I've got bad quality of supply, you know, I used to get 10 units, I now get 3 for the same amount of money, we can look at that and say, well, but you know, this doesn't make sense, because you're saying that actually you haven't changed anything, but the person on the ground is telling us. And then we also say to our compliance team, you prioritize these municipalities to go and audit. So we use all that information. It's not just wasted info. I can't probably go into it, but there are one or two decisions that were made in this particular application that were influenced by those representations. You know? Yes, we get a lot of other information that is good to know, but can't impact directly on this. Okay. So what was that one? Okay, that was the provinces one about the prices. Incidentally, so on this particular application, we had 23,000 submissions or comments on the when we put it out for comments, and probably about 8 of those were, you know, really substantive. On the RCAs that we're doing currently, we've had 80-odd thousand comments. So now we've got to sift through those, and we've had about 23 substantive submissions. But what we do is we take all the others, which are almost social media type, and some of the language I can't say, yeah, but we categorize them into, you know, what are these groups saying and what is this group, and then we see how we can deal with it. So Arthur, yeah, Arthur often talks about all these, you know, big numbers, and as I said, we're not we may well do some forensic type investigations, but around the license conditions. And so we have said maybe this year we need to go and audit the transmission division, and specifically how they schedule and dispatch power stations. You know, that's one of the areas, because IPPs can say they also, even though they're self-dispatching, how do you actually arrange your metered order and all that kind of stuff. So we've never provided them the kind of roadmap we've done in this particular, and I think it's because of where we are and where they are. And then I'll talk about the engagement thing a bit later. So the IPPs that have just been signed that are already operational that might be feeding into the grid, Eskom would come back to us in the next application of the RCA for this year, which will be next to July. They'll come back and say, listen, you gave us 7 billion or 6 billion for IPPs. We actually spent 8. And then we need to make sure that we've approved those contracts, that it was prudently, you know, incurred and all that kind of, and then they would actually get that because it is a pass-through in terms of the mechanism. Just a caveat on that is, so going forward, you know, there was a Section 34 decision by the court that said, you know, NERSA concurred with the minister's determination, etc. And we had run a different process before, but going forward, we will have to run a public consultation process on those concurrences. Not to say the outcomes would be different or whatever, but we need to run a process that's slightly different to what we've done in the past. So what was the other one? Yeah, so about the forecast, what is this? Did I miss it? So in terms of the ESCOM forecast where they've heard, and then they're not collecting the revenue. So ESCOM blames us from the previous decision, and they've made that public, saying that during the process of the last decision for the multi-year, they told us they couldn't, in the middle of it, they told us that they needed to revise the forecast down. And even if we had accepted what they'd given us, they would still been asked for probably 6% or so. But the regulator at the time didn't accept that revision because in the middle of the process, and they said, no, we're keeping you to what you said that the forecast should be. I think there is a question there that says, and I think we've asked those questions to ESCOM in the public hearing today. So what did you do when you saw, in the first year, you saw that you're not meeting the forecast? What did you do? You know, I mean, they did apply for what they call a selective reopen, and the regulator said, no, come with a full application. Don't just try to open small things, you know, in your revenue allocation. What did they do around trying to get big customers to, you know, through maybe a special kind of deal for 2 years, which, you know, we've approved one recently, to get them to keep projects going? What did they do to increase their sales? I mean, the question that I always ask is, so, what size was your sales force and what size is it now? You know, I think it's pretty much the same as it was probably 8 years ago. They are now starting to, but it's today. You know, so there is a question there that is, but as I said, we have allowed them to revise that forecast significantly to reflect the current situation. Okay, what we're saying is you need to then grow from here. We're allowing you to what do you call it, I don't want to use the term rebate because they use that rebate. To revise where you're sitting, and then you need to grow from there. So I think as we go forward, we'll be looking at that. Okay, ESCOM keeps on overspending. Yeah, so the clearing account mechanism for adjustment doesn't allow them to recover any operational expenditure that they spend more than what we allow them. So that's for their bottom line. Now, as a citizen of this country, that doesn't help us, right? Because they're spending more, and where do they get the money? From a regulatory perspective, they can't get that through the consumer through the tariff. Okay. So one that concerns us is the CapEx spending faster than what we had agreed with them, because then how do they service that debt? And then it's not the 40 odd or 70 billion, it's the debt cost on that, which maybe is then 7 or 10 billion, I guess, which is a lot less. And the only thing we can do, as I said, is we can do the tribunal, we can fine them. And I think it probably is something the regulator will talk about as it goes forward, is there are options where you can then have the power to issue what is called a regulatory order that then orders them to do certain things. Right now, if they're inefficient, it's actually for their account or actually the shareholder's account. Sorry, not you. The DPE, the shareholder's account, which is all of us anyway. You know. So this stuff we look at. But we audit them and We do alert them when we see things. So I'll give you an example, is that we did see that the OCGT usage had spiked in the last few months because they had some problems with maintenance, etc. We also then wrote to them to say, listen, what's happening? You know, and they came back and told us they had a few problems, and that stopped now. But it also kind of focuses them on certain areas. You know. I think the last question here was around what is the appetite to exceed. I guess the fact that they haven't taken us to court for review on the 5.23% says that they've accepted that they need to improve what they're doing. My personal view to them is, look, this is where we are. Let's move forward. You know, and as you go forward, we engage in what are the better things you can do and how do you then correctly. But they haven't taken us for review on this decision, although they said so in the media. I mean, I think they actually did say the portfolio committee that they've taken it, but they haven't done it. So if they do that, then you know that they don't have the appetite, and then the court might actually either say to us we weren't 100% correct, or say to them, well, actually you have to. So that's where we are.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sabah, I believe that was what I was scared of already. Also, the member from the ESF, from the POP, has also left. Thank you very much and your team for the presentation of the EPP, the budget, and also presentation on what we did in our strategic planning session. We said when we invite development because of the challenges I expressed earlier of time constraints, that when we invite department, we'll also include the contemporary issues so that we can also get an update on those. So for now, we know that the issue of IPP and also the application by ESCOM. So we do the same with other departments as well. Thank you very much. We will release you now and continue with our internal business as the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and honorable members for inviting us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.